Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and with me here today, back for the first time in a little while. It's been a bit. Tyler Rucker. Tyler, how are you doing? It's a fine day.
Doing good, Nick. Yeah, it's always been a minute until we get back on, and then it just feels so right. So appreciate you having me back on.
That's what happens when I rotate through guests as opposed to having the same co-host on everyone, is I get to talk to a bunch of people. So it's good times.
It's a good time, especially, you know, it's fun this time of the year when we get to hop on the pods and get caught up and prepare for the beast ahead. So, I'm happy to be on, and it's going to be a fun one.
Yeah, and it's going to be a fun one because it's always a fun one, but also because we're talking about one of our shared favorite prospects in this class, and in my case, anyway, in a little while, one of my favorite guard prospects I've evaluated in a minute here in Dylan Harper for Rutgers. And so I had a couple questions to start, but let's start with the one that I almost always start with. What made you decide to write about Harper for this piece at this time of the year?
You know, it's funny because I feel like with No Ceilings, we're always trying to get some light on the lower names, give them the spotlight throughout the year. And
I almost made a note of how, you know, the premise of Deep Dives was originally, hey, let's see who's, you know, not at the top. And here we are. I've talked about Cooper Flagg on here, I think, twice or three times now. And now we're on Dylan Harper. So, you know.
It's funny how it works out, because I feel like we're always trying to sprinkle the big names to start the year. And then we're like, okay, let's talk about everybody else. Then, you know, when it gets time to closer to the draft, we're like, okay, let's remind everyone about, you know, the grand prizes at the top. But Steven wrote a great piece about Cooper Flagg, and I'd realize, like, man, I'm waiting to see if anyone's going to take that jump on Dylan Harper. And I was like watching his tape, and I just absolutely love him as a prospect. And I was like, screw it. Like, let's do it. I'll write about Harper. And yeah, it's a fun one. I was very, very excited. It's one of those pieces where I feel like, you know how it is too, Nick, like this time of the year when you kind of get a lightning bolt about like, hey, I want to write about this. You're like, just run with it. Just go with it. And watching his tape, and I was just like, I'm a big fan right now. This is going to be a fun one to write. So let me dive into that one.
So you mentioned Steven's Cooper Flagg piece, and that's actually a perfect way to transition into the next question I wanted to ask, which is one that I discussed with Steven from the opposite end of how, in terms of, you know, internal tiers, which is something that I did loosely for a while and started doing sort of more rigorously last cycle, and you know, have continued that this cycle, is I have constantly struggled with the notion of having a one player tier. And it was part of why the reason that I sort of formally started doing tiers last cycle was because the cycle before was the Victor Wembanyama cycle. It was like, okay, so I guess it's just Wemby at the top in a tier of his own and then everybody else. And it just felt weird to me. And that's part of why I moved Harper into tier one pretty early in the cycle and have had him there essentially since. And it's been interesting to kind of tangle with my thought process on that front, because when I jumped Harper up into that tier was right before Cooper Flagg had his offensive explosion, and also right before Harper was sick and had four pretty tough games in January, again, while he was playing through illness. And, you know, it was visibly obvious in any of those games that he was not even close to 100%, that he would be lucky to be at 50%, right? But
right.
The timing of that was very interesting from the sort of philosophical standpoint of, I think Cooper Flagg is going to be exceptional, and therefore it wouldn't be, especially given the way that Cooper Flagg is discussed, and I think it's entirely fair to be clear, but given the way he's discussed, it's like, okay, this would be a reasonable year to have a similar situation to the Wemby draft of, okay, I guess this is one of those situations where I have to sort of compromise my philosophy and say he's just so far ahead that he has to be in a tier of his own. And you know, again, with the Wembanyama draft, I mean, Brandon Miller came on very strong and was a, you know, clear top three contender pretty early on in his season last year. Scoot Henderson obviously was someone who had quite a lot of love at No Ceilings, who I had ahead of Brandon Miller in that draft right behind Wemby. But even still, it was like, these guys are great prospects who certainly either Scoot or Brandon Miller would have been number one with a bullet in last year's draft, but they're in the Wembanyama draft, so they have to be in the tier below. And I'm curious with Harper, because I boosted him into the Cooper Flag tier entirely on the strength of his own play. And then Cooper had his offensive explosion. And again, you know, my debate has been, is there such a drastic gap between these two that I have to separate Cooper out into a top tier by himself? And I don't know. I mean, I heard the one side of it, you know, discuss the one side of it with Steven when we talked about it from the Cooper Flag perspective. And I'm curious your thoughts now that we're talking about it from the Harper perspective, because again, it would almost feel like denigrating Harper at this point to separate Cooper out, but that's not how I'm looking at it, if that makes any sense at all.
No, it makes complete sense to me. You know, I'm probably the perfect person to talk to about this because I hate tiers. I can't stand them. And it's mainly because of exactly what you're talking about. Like it plays such mind games with your evaluation. You're like, well, if I have both of these guys in such high, you know, regard or respect, like, do I have to separate them from a tier? And I would have both of them in their own tier right now if I was making it by tiers. Like I think that highly of Harper. Cooper's been unbelievable the second half of the year. Just did like a dive kind of before this, looking at his numbers, and I was just like laughing hysterically. But
you sent a message to the group chat this morning about how he's at just under 50-50-90 over his last 10 games.
Yeah, and almost like 20 a game. So I was like, yeah, he's having a pretty good stretch of the year.
He's doing all right.
But, you know, it's important. Like, I think they both could be superstars from this class. I think they could both be all NBA guys from this class. They both are, you know, Cooper's this lengthy forward, which the league is obsessed with forwards. It's so important if you can have an alpha at that position. He does a little bit of everything. He's fantastic. He's got good size. He's got good length. But then, you know, Dylan Harper is not just like a 6'2 guard that's doing this. He's 6'5. So he's stocky. He's going to be a positional advantage because of his size, his versatility. And like you were saying, before he had the flu, where, you know, reports came out he lost like 15 pounds because of how sick he was, he was averaging 22-5-5 almost, with splits of I think 52-37-75.
Yep.
And the funny part about the 75 was he had a game to start the year where he was 1-for-6 from the free throw line. So if you throw that out, it's basically he was 80% from the line. And then he had that flu bug, and I think 5 games later after he had the flu, when he's trying to get back, he was like 11-3-2, but it was terrible. It was like, oh gosh, he looks so like bad. And we all would, right? It was kind of like, you could tell how tough he is for just trying to play, but I think he's right up there. I think there is a gap. I don't think it's as big as people think. You know, I've talked to people around the league that even were like, I'm really struggling because I might have him higher. Now, that was before Cooper went on a war path, so I'm sure that conversation might be interesting to revisit. But he's got a lot of fans in NBA circles. I think people think that highly of him. I think it's going to be one of those. It should be 1 and 2. I just think Harper's that special. So yeah, if I was making a tier, they would both be in a tier of themselves right now.
It's fascinating, just leading on from your discussion to sort of link back to the one I had with Steven, but also to just focus it on Dylan Harper. I think part of the interest of the debate is we've never really seen a Cooper Flag before. It's like somewhere between Andrei Kirilenko and Draymond Green and, I don't know, maybe Jason Tatum, of like just this mix of, we haven't seen the level of offensive feel with the kind of defensive flexibility that Cooper provides, because he's not quite the Draymond style of defender, but that's sort of the best comp I can think of in terms of a forward who really just does make his presence felt everywhere defensively. And, you know, when I talked to Jam about Cooper Flagg a couple months ago at this point, you know, my sort of lead into that discussion was how my father is, you know, he's a boomer. He's in his, you know, mid 60s. So it's not entirely out of line, but also yet somehow feels like his takes are 20 years older than he is, of like, oh, you know, people discount Bill Russell in the GOAT discussion because of how, but, you know, all of it for my dad centers on how good are these guys defensively? Because like everybody can look and see, okay, this guy's scoring 30 points a game. But one of my father and my shared favorite players who I had thought of in a, as a Cooper Flagg comparison in a weird way is Ben Wallace, of, okay, he only scores 10 points a game, but an 80 to 65 win is just as much of a win as a 115 to 100 win. And if you add, if you only score 10 points, but you take 20 points off the board for the other team, that's essentially a 30 point swing. And I was thinking of it, you know, again, at the time before the offensive explosion, of if Cooper Flagg adds 15 points a night and takes away 15 points a night from the other team, that's not as visible of a superstar. It's not one that we're sort of used to kind of wrapping our minds around, but, you know, pretty much every NBA era has one of those guys, right? Like it was Draymond Green in the current era. It was Ben Wallace in his era. It was Dennis Rodman in his era, right? Of like, this guy is such an outlier defensively that even though there are offensive holes, he's still a superstar. And with Cooper, the offensive holes are filled more, but even still, it's like, this is not the archetype, the mold of a prospect that we've seen before. We have seen Dylan Harper's before. I mean, just, you know, even right now off the top of my head, it's like Cade Cunningham, very easy to directly compare to Dylan Harper, you know, like someone who you buy into the shooting potential, but maybe the shooting's not all the way there, but the passing is special and the at-rim finishing is ridiculous. And therefore, you can imagine, okay, this guy, we give him the ball every time. He's a big point guard. We've seen big point guards before, right? Like, we've seen big point guards since Magic, right? This is not even close to a new phenomenon, whereas Cooper is just so different in the ways that he impacts the game from really anybody that I can think of that we've seen before, that, you know, on the one hand, it makes him stand out more as a quote-unquote unicorn. But on the other hand, it's like, this is a situation where, and again, because of Cooper's game, it's not like we need to find the right fit for him as much as it is for some other sort of wonky archetypes. But anytime a player comes along that's unique, GMs are going to play it safe, right? Because, oh, if I pick the unique guy and he turns out to be a bust, I lose my job. If I pick the guy that everybody thinks is a top three pick and he ends up being a bust, I can say, well, but everybody else thought, you know, this is the guy that should have gone, you know, 2, 1, 3, whatever the hell in the draft, right? Okay, this is some, again, if it's a movie that we've seen before, it's easier for it to be a quote unquote safe pick. And maybe Cooper just sort of breaks that dichotomy, but it is interesting to me that, you know, it's, Dylan Harper is a player that we've seen before. You know, I mean, literally his father was a longtime NBA player. They have very different games, but, you know, conceptually, right, we've seen a Dylan Harper archetype. We know what a Dylan Harper archetype looks like in a way that we don't quite with Cooper.
Yeah, I, you know, it's one of those things where when you, Cooper's going to get all the hype in the world, he should. It's well-deserved. It is very unique. I like that, you know, I heard that on, Bill Simmons with Kyle Mann, they were talking about like, hey, can we get away from our generational? And they're like, I like unique better. And I was like, I like that.
I have a different take on generational, which I gave last time, and I won't give in too much more detail now. Unique is interesting because it's a word that it means one of one. And I think people use it more often than one on one. But I also have an issue with generational in that a generation is a period of time. You don't have a generational prospect every other year. That's not how the word generational works.
I agree.
Like, yeah.
Can't stand it.
That's, you know, my editor brain nitpicking the language here. But no, I mean, I think the concept is right of, okay, this this guy doesn't look like anything we've seen before. And I don't know. I feel like there needs to be an intermediate word of like, there are a couple guys who are sort of similar, but not unique, but also not generational, because that's not, I'm getting into Graham Recorder, which I shouldn't.
No, you're fine. Because what I was trying to get at is like, Cooper is very unique. I think Dylan's unique. Okay. He has a lot of similarities to, like, Cade Cunningham is a very, very big one. If you go look at the numbers, there's a lot of that. I think Corey was spot on at the beginning of the year. He shouted out, he's like, Cade and Dylan Harper, and keep saying, like, tap the sign. Like, yes, like, Corey was spot on about that one. I think there's a little bit more, like, there's some burst that I think he's got a little bit more of a quick step than Cade. Now, obviously, I'd have to go back and rewatch Cade, but I remember Cade had good footwork, Cade, like, obviously his size, but I also think Dylan's defense is, like, just kind of teased, like, because he can be a pest on that side of the ball, and it's always one of these things, too, where I think when guys take that next step of, like, now I'm in the league, I feel like there's another switch or another something goes on that, like, you're ultra competitive now, like, yeah. you picked your spots in high school, you pick your spots in college to buy yourself some time. I still think the defensive side of the ball could be really special for him, but, you know, he has so many different ways he can beat you offensively, where his body, his strengths, his quickness, his playmaking, like, he can just go bully you in the post when he understands everyone's smaller than him. Or he can kind of pick you apart with his handles and stuff. I just think these are two unique guys. And I think Dylan's also going to be one of these players. Like, I love him off the ball too. So in a league that's kind of transitioning to, like, hey, we don't just have this, like, black and white, this is our point guard, this is our shooting guard, it feels like now you're kind of like, hey, what can give us some versatility? I think Dylan's going to even be able to offer teams that of, like, hey, I can play off the ball. You can kind of give two guards out there at the same time if you want. He's a fun one. Like, every time I watch him, there's something else with his game that I fall in love with or I'm intrigued with. So that's when you know you have a special prospect, when you're, man, every time I watch him, I find another area that I'm intrigued with. Or you always leave the tape, like, in a good mood, it feels like. Even some of his bad stuff, you're like, hey, I at least understand the processing or what he's trying to do. And then he's just a nasty guard out there.
So let's actually get into the specifics of the article. I do very much want to put a pin into the off-ball stuff because I do want to get back to it. But let's just sort of start up top. And it's, you know, you mentioned the stats in the first 13 games for Harper. I think that's almost exactly when I wrote about Harper for my editor's notes piece back in December, because that's the numbers that you have for the first 13 games is essentially exactly what I remember writing for that piece. But I think coming into the year with Harper, the biggest sort of concern was, can this guy shoot in any sort of real way? And the early numbers, particularly the first 13 games that you pointed out, 53% from the field, 37% from three-point range, 75% from the free throw line, with that caveat of the 1-for-6 game that, if you take it out, brings his percentages up to 80. That's pretty solid. That's a really strong start. And again, you know, I think there's a whole lot of intrigue with the offensive game, but really for me, I think the biggest question was, okay, can the shot be there? And the early returns, and less so the more recent returns, but even still at a very high level, the results have been, the shooting is good enough. The at-rim scoring, which I thought would be good, has not only been good, but been spectacular in a way. It's like, okay, this is not only something where, like, this is a skill for him, this is something that is plus-plus even for NBA level of, this guy is going to be a force around the rim. And that, I think, is where the athleticism that you brought in comes to bear. Of Cade, for all of his incredible talents, you know, he's a wonderful basketball player. I loved him in his draft. I think he's incredibly fun to watch now. But again, for all of the positive things that we can say about Cade, what we can't say is that he's an athlete around the basket in the way that Dylan Harper is.
Right. And I think that's one of the areas in his game, you know, when it comes to Dylan, is it kind of snuck up on you. And it still does at times. You're kind of expecting it like, oh, he's listed around 6'5", 6'6", like 215. Like, he's stocky. And you kind of, when you're first watching him, you're expecting him not to have this pop. And you're like, okay, he's probably not going to be a guy that finishes above the rim. And then I think he had, I think it was back against Alabama or maybe it was against Princeton. He had a sequence where he went and just threw down a nasty slam, like off a drive. And you're like, where the heck did that come from? So he's got it. I think what's so good with his game is he understands how to kind of set you up. Like, he doesn't show you all of the gifts he has right away. He knows when to pick his spots, and he kind of like plays under control, and then all of a sudden can be really lightning quick. And then you think like, oh, he just finishes around the basket with finesse, and then he all of a sudden throws down with power. Like, he's just got a lot of a good understanding with his game of like, I can kind of throw, I'm not going to show you everything at once, but I know when to surprise you and when to kind of reach in my bag of tricks and pull a rabbit out of a hat.
I'm just going to quote you directly from the piece here, because you said it much better than I could, especially trying to summarize it off the top of my head. Dylan Harper switches gears like a sports car out for a drive on a sunny day. And I love that line, but also I think, you know, there's something in there of something that I have talked about. I'm almost certain I brought it up with you at one point, because I feel like I bring it up pretty much every podcast, of something that I always look for in young guards is how many different speeds can you play at? That is so much more important to me than top line speed. And, you know, I've used De'Aaron Fox in these comparisons consistently, and given how the divorce between him and the Kings went, maybe there are Kings fans out there who don't want me to talk about De'Aaron Fox anymore, but you know, I've said this before. I think my Kings fandom is very important to my draft evaluations, because since I'm invested in a team that consistently has terrible lottery picks, you know, I watch the development of these guys pretty close to firsthand. And the thing with Fox that always, you know, he's the fastest guy in the league, right? And that was sort of, you know, the developmental, that was like the big blaring headline of, you know, you draft this guy because he's a lefty with, you know, good touch around the basket, but he's the fastest guy in the league. And his rookie year, he just got bottled up constantly because, you know, it's like, here we go. This is the real Rucker Nick podcast moment where I get to a baseball reference of, if you're a Major League Baseball player and you know 100 right down the middle is coming, you can adjust and you can hit that. So, you know, if you throw 102, but it's always right down the middle, you know, like maybe you strike out the first couple of guys, but you know, by the time you get to the second time through the order, it's like, okay, I'm just waiting on the fastball because he doesn't have anything else. And that was De'Aaron Fox's rookie year. He had the fastball. He didn't have everything else. And so for me, when I see a freshman point guard, like a true freshman point guard who, you know, the top line athleticism is great. And again, you know, it gives him a ceiling in a way that someone like a Cade doesn't have. But what really stands out to me, and it's the reason why I'm the only one who hasn't given up on Nolan Traore yet, is when I see a young point guard at that age who can manage a game, but also switch speeds, not just play at whatever their top line speed is, not just, you know, okay, he, you know, he has good hezzy, but, you know, he doesn't use that in the way that he should. Dylan Harper manipulates the pace in a way that a veteran point guard should. And so when I see that kind of veteran savvy in a teenage point guard, it always draws me. It always makes me have them maybe higher than I should in terms of my own evaluation, because again, it's something that even all-star, all-NBA caliber point guards often have to develop at the NBA level. When you don't have to develop that at the NBA level, that's just such a higher starting point than it is for guys who need to go through that development process.
Absolutely. Gosh, the baseball, I've missed the baseball terminology. It makes my day every time we get it. You know, it's like Chapman who's throwing 100, or Alondis Chapman. And then I always say his first name wrong. How do you say it?
Aroldis.
Yeah.
I'm painfully like, familiar because
yeah, exactly.
For my baseball teams,
I get it.
The Reds and the Yankees. So,
well, people caught up to it. Like, you, okay, 100's coming. I get it. But then you get guys, you know, Hall of Fame pitchers like Greg Maddux. They're not going to throw that speed, but they will pick you apart with their speed, their control. And, you know, it's, I know what you're saying about Fox. That was someone when I evaluated him, I'm like, yeah, he's got elite speed, but is this more of a, you know, like a four speed with his shifts, or is it a sports car where he's got six speeds? I think Dylan's got six. I think Dylan understands how to set you up with first gear for third and fourth for sixth. And he doesn't get to sixth often because he knows if I need that extra gear, it's here. And you see times where you're like, where did this speed come from? But it's just going back to baseball. He's like, there's a lot of legendary pitchers that threw very, very hard that also had other pitches to complement it. You know, Randy Johnson, Nolan Ryan, they had nasty stuff to set you up. So I think that's, I love how much we go baseball, basketball. I think that's where Dylan is like, Dylan can set you up with changeups and curveballs, and he has that fastball that he can blow you away, but he just doesn't need it all the time. And pairing that with his frame is what's so different than a normal point guard prospect. Is like, he is also going to be bigger, most likely, than NBA guys guarding him in the same position. So it's a really special talent, and the IQ, the awareness with the handles, it's just the full package.
The Randy Johnson comparison, I think, is perfect, because the concept here is, look, if you don't have the top end speed, you have to master everything else. Like Greg Maddux, as you mentioned, right? Like, his control was so spectacular that, you know, the fact that he wasn't going to hit 100 miles an hour didn't matter, because, you know, again, it's similar to like late career Jamie Moyer, right? Of, and similar, honestly, to the Ben Wallace discussion that I brought up earlier, right? Of the difference between 185 is the same in raw numbers as it is between 85 and 70, right? So right. If you set, you know, it's the classic thing that players would say about Jamie Moyer, right? Of like, God, that 85 looks like 95 because he sets it up with a 60 mile an hour curveball.
Right, like, okay. Right.
But, you know, the difference there is, you know, maybe mixing speeds is more important. You know, you can be a Greg Maddux mixing speeds and get by. You can be, you know, a James Harden, a Lucas Doncic of, okay, the top line speed might not be the same, but what with my deceleration and body control, I can make it the same. The flip side is, you know, this might seem obvious to say, but I think needs to be said anyway. If you have all of those things, then you have a lot more to play with, right?
Yeah.
If you, you know, like, if you have both the De'Aaron Fox top line speed and the Luka Doncic deceleration and the sort of Chris Paul changing pace, changing speeds, managing the game, managing the tempo, right? Like, Randy Johnson early in his career didn't quite have it figured out, but once he got into his mid 20s and figured it out, nobody could do anything to stop him, right? It's like, okay, if you have 80% of the toolkit and you have it 95% mastered, you're going to do a lot better than someone who has 100% of the toolkit but only has it 50% mastered. But if you have 100% of the toolkit and you have it like 95% mastered, nobody can reach you, right? That's where that's where the ceiling discussion comes into play, right? Of, if everything gets figured out, Dylan Harper has a larger toolkit to draw from than Cade Cunningham does. And maybe it doesn't, right? That's the thing with prospects. Maybe it doesn't work out the way that we think it does. But Harper brings this combination of that sort of veteran savvy, that feel, that ability to mix speeds with also having six gears, right? Like, if you have four gears and you switch between them better than anybody else, you can still be a Hall of Famer in either sport, right? But if you have both the toolkit and you know how to use it, that's where things get really spicy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, you said that perfectly at the end. You can have four gears and be exceptional with those gears and be a problem. A lot of guys, like, very successful at, like, I don't know if Luka has six, but his four or five are unbelievable. And I just think it's kind of putting that together perfectly. Like, he's got, like I said, he has a bigger toolkit to pull from, because he also has like I'll just use my strengths to beat you. So like, he can set you up with footwork. He can set you up with all these different gadgets and to get you guessing. And you know, how you said about Randy Johnson, like Randy Johnson became effective because people always were afraid of how fast he would throw. And then he started throwing all this other stuff. So you're like, my head's a nightmare before I even know what's going on. It's how I felt about Steph Castle as a prospect. Like, he had the size, he had the, you know, the hesitation, the ability to understand how to set people up with change of gears. You have to have stuff with that. Like, you have to have the handles, you have to have the feel, you have to also be able to be a playmaker. Like, you can't just like, oh, I know how to change gears, but my handle's pretty weak. Like, no, that doesn't really work. You have to have a lot of a good foundation and be able to pull from those tools, that kit, whenever you need it. So I just think I see a lot of similarities with Harper, where it's just I like how you put that, like the veteran mentality. Like, those are the prospects I always just gush over, is like, oh, this guy looks like he's been in the league for 5 years and he's still young. And what is this going to look like after he's been in the league for a while? Like, it's only going to get better and it's only going to get scarier.
So let's move into the playmaking aspect. And just quick aside, if you're not a baseball person and you're very confused by the previous discussion,
we'll limit it.
I have three words for you. Just look up Randy Johnson Bird and you will understand everything that we just talked about. RIP to that bird. But anyway, sorry, spoiler alert. Anyway, moving on to the playmaking stuff. And I'm just going to quote you again from the piece here. And I think, you know, because this lends into everything that we've been talking about so far, Harper can do a bit of everything as a floor general. And then a little bit of an ellipses, because I'm going to cut to the start of the next paragraph. It's an understanding of realizing what scoring gravity will do, not only for yourself, but for setting up teammates for easy looks. And that, I think, encapsulates all of this right here, right? Of there are plenty of people that we can evaluate as exceptionally talented scoring guards. Like, I have Trey Johnson in my top five at this point, because I think he's that gifted of a scorer. And I buy into the playmaking potential. But that's the thing. I have to say, potential, when I discuss that with Trey Johnson. Dylan Harper, until recently, you know, his, again, as you mentioned, his scoring average dipped below 20 recently, but until recently, he was also putting up 20 a game, also on good shooting splits, but doing that while being this spectacular floor general who, I don't want to be mean, but given the surrounding context of this Rutgers offense, the fact that he's even at 4 assists per game is impressive. And, you know, again, the way you said it, you know, he can do a bit of everything as a floor general. He can, you know, this is something that I've also talked about quite a bit, of the difference between sort of game manager types and real playmakers. Of the game manager is like, okay, they see all the reads that they need to see. They'll make the right pass. They won't make a mistake, you know, all of those things. But what they won't give you is, you know, what I've referred to as the sort of the LeBron Luka, the home run pass, this was not going to be any sort of anything. And I've turned this from, you know, a 10% chance scoring look to an 80% chance scoring look because, you know, I hit this ridiculous 60-foot hit ahead pass that hit my guy right in stride. You're nodding along. You know exactly what I mean. And the distinction that I make there is between, you know, the guy who sees everything, makes the right read, but doesn't have that sort of audacity. And then someone like a Luka or LeBron who, again, creates something out of nothing. And Harper, you know, the next line that I didn't mention, one of my favorite parts of his abilities as a distributor is his reactionary playmaking. And that, I think, really leads into the sort of audacity element of, you know, that's not, here are my reads, I'm, you know, making my reads, this guy's sort of open, this guy, you know, I need to maybe hesitate to get a good look, and I'm hunting good looks. Whereas the audacious guys is like, I might be able to create a great look out of this rather than just a good look. And Harper has the sort of baseline of he can do the game manager stuff, but there's a next level that even really good passers don't necessarily have, that Harper has, again, that tool in his toolkit.
Yeah, there's the robotic, like you're saying, of and robotic might be the wrong, like a little too harsh, but just like understanding like, hey, here's my first look. Here's my second look. If this isn't open, then we're continuing the set and motion, whatever you want to say. But I also think there's the guys that go off script and the improvisers. And that's kind of where I love the, I always say it's reactionary playmaking. I know other people might have like a different phrase, but it's just kind of like, hey, if I all of a sudden they send a double over, he can react in a split second and know where the ball should go. I think you see that a lot of times with Dylan is he can also drive and understand everyone that claps on him. And then it's a wraparound dump off for an easy dunk. Or there's just a lot of really good times where you feel like watching the tape at the last second, you're like, oh, he's screwed. Like he's going to get blocked at the rim. And all of a sudden you're like, wait, how did he get the pass off? Like, how did it's, I had a couple times where I had to rewind it because I was like, I didn't even see where he passed it. So it just is, that's also the maturity of just like, wait till that last second with that window, like wait till they have, they're all in with committing to you. And I think he does a great job of understanding that. And, you know, you see games where he takes over with just his playmaking. He's got games where he takes 10 shots total and you look up and you're like, how did he have 25 and 6? Like and he had a game against Columbia. I think they were trying to dare him to shoot and he just kind of stayed back and pulled a Rajon Rondo. He's just picking apart people with assists. He had a triple double. He had 16, 11 and 12. So he can get those games where like he can get red hot and just take over scoring. He can also pick you apart with his playmaking and then he can kind of mix and match both where he's like, I'm red hot now. And now they're coming up and now I can drive and distribute. So I think that's where you see the maturity. That's where you see like, oh, this is a potential star because that recognition at that age just shows you he's a student of the game and understands kind of the flow and how to adapt and react.
I'm really glad that you brought up the artistry of passing because it gives me an in to give one of the weirdest analogies that I've given on this show, but the more I equivocate before introducing it, the more I feel like this is actually indicative of something. It's the difference between cooking and baking. My grandmother was one of the best bakers that I've ever known. She would do holiday cookies and they would be like the kinds of things where my father, made one of her old recipes and gave it out to people in Los Angeles, right? The I don't eat any sugar capital of the world. And these things were devoured in moments. And with baking, it's so, so precise. It's chemistry. It's if you add, you know, a quarter cup more milk than you should, you'll get something that falls apart rather than, you know, an actual baked good. Whereas my father is he's a decent baker. He learned from my grandmother, but he's an exceptional cook. And my older younger brother, I have two younger brothers. The older of my younger brothers is spectacular at both things. Like just, I cannot truly praise his ability to turn garbage into food enough. And you know, really where I'm going with this, because I promise I am going somewhere with this, is you talk to my brother about cooking and he's like, oh, you just, you know, you figure it out. A little pinch of this, a little bit of that, you know, you can tell, you know, when it's getting to the point of, I got to take it off now because I want it medium rare. I don't want it medium. Shout out to Nathan Grubel. And, you know, that's sort of where all of this comes into play of, look, you know, there are a lot of people who have incredible flair, who know, all right, a little pinch of this, a little dash of that, and, you know, my stir fry or whatever the hell I'm cooking is going to be excellent. But, like, for me, I learned how to cook from my dad and my brother, and I'm a pretty good cook, I'm not going to lie, but I cannot bake to save my life. I fuck it up every single time because that, you know, I'm pretty good at following instructions, but for some reason with baking, it's like I slip a little bit and I'm like, that's probably fine. That's probably fine. And when I'm cooking, it is probably fine. And right, it turns out fine. But when I'm baking, you know, I add a little bit too much flour and I screwed it up again. Great. I screwed it up again. Fantastic. That's exactly what I'm looking for, right? But that's sort of the distinction. And if you're able to do both, right, then everybody wants you to be the person in charge of food all the time, right? And for me, it was like, I've, you know, made dinner for groups of friends and it's turned out pretty well. But if you ask me to bake a cake, it's like, I'm going to go to the store and buy one from someone who actually knows how to do this. And with the passing element, which is, you know, what in theory I was actually talking about here, it's the notion of you can follow the rigid game plan. This is what this play looks like. I, you know, bring the ball up top. I wait 2 seconds for the big man to set a screen in the paint. I wait for the guy I'm making the play for to come off the pin down. I hit him with the pass here at this moment as he's curling around this screen and he takes the shot. And I do that, or whatever version of that it is, 17 consecutive times. And then the cooking is, oh, okay, we're out on the break. It's a 3-on-2. Do I, you know, charge all the way to the rim myself and then wait till the last second for the pass? That's maybe the best look. Or, hey, you know, the defender's cheating a little bit towards the guy who's spotting up on the wing, so I have a more open lane to the basket. I'm just going to challenge this guy 1-on-1, right? That's sort of the improvisational element of it. You know, the cooking element of it, right? The random playmaking that you sort of mentioned, that's that. And the, I'm going to run the set play that coach gave me 17 times in a row and make the read that I'm supposed to make every time, that's baking. And some guys are really good at one. The comparison that I always used was when I was comparing Iverson Molinar to Alondis Williams, who neither of them unfortunately turned out the way I might have liked them to, but that was the idea. Iverson Molinar was the game manager. Alondis Williams was the home run hitting, the home run passer. And when you have both, it's special in a way that, again, even really, really great NBA players, some of them can't quite manage.
Absolutely. No, I like how you put that, because we'll watch plenty of tape and the guy throws a gorgeous pass for an assist and you're like, well, was that by design? Like, was he supposed to be that open by the set they ran? Or, you know, I like how you put that, because there is guys that you could tell when that first look isn't there off a set, all of a sudden everything just goes out the door and you're like, okay, well, you have to react now. Like, what's the next move here? Like, and I think you see a lot of times where it is like the cooking, where it's like you can adjust to make your dish a little bit better. With baking, if you skip a step, it's you're screwed. You're done. You got no shot. So I like that, because I think with Harper, it's like he is the chef in the kitchen where he's cooking, and oh, it's not salty enough. He'll figure a way to make it a little taste better. Like, he just can kind of do a little bit of everything. He understands running a set. Like, hey, if it's not there, here's my continuation. Here's where we're looking. You were very polite earlier when you were saying, like, hey, the team's not the greatest around them. And I think a lot of people understand it if you're watching them. Like, they've struggled. But what he's done this year has been really, really impressive. I mean, and talking about, like, that's – if you throw out that stretch where he lost 15 pounds because of an illness, like, he'd still be up in that category of 25-5, where we would be like, we sure – I don't think it's that humongous. Now, you could say it's a gap. I don't think it's a gigantic gap, because you still have a potential 6'6 floor general with three-level scoring ability and defensive upside. Like, he just checks all the boxes for me. So I just think he is special with the ball in his hands, and I think he's going to check a lot of boxes at the next level too.
So let's actually talk about the defense now. And I'm very curious for your thoughts on this, because it's been a little while since I did my Harper deep dive to write about him for the editor's notes piece that I did. But I'm curious your thoughts, because my sort of take on his defense when I was doing the deep dive for that piece, and, like, you know, it's not like I haven't seen him play since, but, you know, there's a difference between the deep dive and, you know, just trying to keep up with prospects, at least for me anyway. And with Harper, again, I'm curious your thoughts, because the way I saw it was he's got a lot of the shutdown corner stuff. But when I did my dive, I was like, I came away much more impressed with the offense than I had been before. And slightly less impressed with the defense. I think that, again, I'm not saying that I think he'll be, I mean, pretty much all rookies are bad defensively, but mm-hmm. I think he will be a plus defensively at the NBA level. I'm not sure how much of a plus. So I'm curious your thoughts on his play on that side of the ball.
Yeah, I mean, if you read my piece, you probably are going to be like, oh my gosh, is he that good of a defender? I'm like, no, there's still a lot that he needs to work on. It's a consistency thing with me. And I always, this is probably the tough part of personally when I'm evaluating a guy like this, is like the situation. I'm like, okay, is the offensive workload paying a toll on the defensive focus? Because there's times when you see him locked in, he's got incredible gifts where it comes to like his lateral quickness, his size. He knows how to get nasty when he needs to. I think I just like to see it a little bit more consistently. And I'm wondering if sometimes it's weird where like these guys take that next jump to the next level and then they're like, all right, I'm really going to lock in defensively. And you're like, what? And then all of a sudden, but it's like the point guard position is so tough because you're now, your head's going to be all over the place because you're also balancing, you know, personalities and people's shots and everything. So I left the defense, I left the film the same way you did. Like the offense, I got, whoa, man, there's more here than I thought I was going to love. And the defense, I'm like, okay, there's stuff there. It's just, can it come around a little bit more? His off-ball stuff impressed me a lot. And it's the reaction speed with his anticipation is like unbelievable. It's just, he had a couple sequences where I think he like, I don't even know if he was looking at the ball. and he like, he jumped the passing lane. I think he was just like, reading his man, and his guy kind of flashed up and he just immediately went up to like go steal it. And I was like, was he even looking at the ball? Like there's just some really good off ball stuff. There's some bouncing the floor defensively where he knows like how to kind of cheat a little. I say cheating, but it's like just kind of tiptoeing like yourself to be like in that perfect window to attack. He's just really good with timing and anticipation, but the on-ball stuff, I think, is the area where I think he's got a lot of room to improve. I think it's just a consistency thing for me. But, you know, I talked about this with Metcalf, I think, on one episode. I was like, you know, I always, when I'm evaluating, I always think that, like, when we say, hey, when the game slows down, like, think of how good they're going to be in it. I always feel like I forget, like, that could mean defensively, too. Like, when the game slows down defensively, and they understand, you know, what teams are trying to accomplish, that's where I think Harper will get really dangerous. And, you know, his dad was an unbelievable defender for years. So I imagine that'll probably be a quick conversation if his defense is ever struggling. They'd be like, what are you doing? You're making me look bad. So I don't know. I think it left me wanting more, but there was just some flashes where I was like, oh my gosh, if we do get more, you know, I felt the same way about watching Amen Thompson. Like as a prospect, I was like, when he's locked in, there is scary stuff here. Can we get the more locked in? And then now all of a sudden we're seeing it in, you know, Amen's second year where it's like, oh gosh, yep, it's here. So
here we are.
Here we are. It's fantastic. So I guess that's where I kind of watch Dylan, and you're seeing what he's doing offensively. You're seeing how much he's putting on that side of the ball. It's like, well, maybe if things slow down and he gets a little bit more consistent on this other side of the ball, maybe things get more dangerous. And I also think when you're one of the top five picks and everyone's expecting it, you probably have a little bit more of a leash to be like, coach got mad at me about my defense, but what, is he going to not play me? Like,
yeah.
And I'm not saying Dylan's ever thinking that, but when you get to the NBA, they're like, yeah, we'll sit you. Like, clearly we'll put you on the bench if you're not going to play defense. So, I understand what you're saying though. Like I left it encouraged with the flashes, but wanting a bit more. It's just one of those things like, okay, I need to see it a little bit more.
I'm really glad that you brought up the off-ball defensive stuff for multiple reasons, but for one of the reasons, which is I mentioned earlier that we were going to put a pin in the complementary skills and then proceeded to never refer back to it. So that's on me, but I do want to get into that discussion because I think it's very important with Harper that everything that he does not as the lead guy is not just good, but superlative, ridiculously good. He's an 87th percentile cutter. He's an 85th percentile spot up shooter. When he's unguarded on catch and shoots, he shoots in the 88th percentile, all of these numbers per synergy. It's the kind of thing where he is tasked with doing so, so, so much for Rutgers. But, you know, a lot of the time with those kinds of players, it's like, okay, you know, like this was a discussion that I had with, I think it was Metcalf, with about Jalen Hojifino back in the day of, okay, but when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, what does he do, right? Like, how does he help your team when he doesn't have the ball in his hands? And with Harper, every single one of those discussions is incredibly encouraging to me of, oh, what does Dylan Harper do when he doesn't have the ball in his hands? He makes a ridiculous percentage of his unguarded catch and shoot looks. He's an exceptional cutter. He's a great spot up shooter. It's just, you know, again, his shot numbers overall are dragged down by the fact that he's an average. And I say, you know, it's very important. He's average. He's 47th percentile as a dribble jumper shooter. He shoots them in terms of the percentage of time that he shoots them. He's in the 94th percentile, right? It's the Rutgers offense forces him to take an awful lot of those off the dribble looks that were my primary concern with him heading into this year. And what he's shown is I can be okay at that. I can be average at that. When he's as good as he is at everything else, that's all he needs to be. But the flip side of that is this is how good he is when he's forced to do a lot of the things that he's not necessarily as good at. When he's forced to take a lot of these off the dribble jumpers, where he's forced to, you know, oftentimes be tasked with difficult point of attack defensive assignments. But all of the complementary skills, all of the secondary skills around that, all of the what does this guy do when he's not the focus, whether it be the focus offensively with the ball in his hands or the focus defensively as a point of attack isolation defender rather than as a help defender. And the really encouraging stuff is this is how good he looks when he's forced into a role that doesn't fit him. Imagine what happens when he has shooters around him and he doesn't have to take all of these off the dribble jumpers and he has some support at the point of attack so he can roam a bit more defensively, right? Sometimes that's the kind of thing where, again, with Jalen Hojifino, it's okay. And I'll admit I was too high on Hojifino because I bought into the stuff that he can do and was maybe not as concerned as I should have been on the what does he do without the ball in his hands question. With Harper, it's the opposite of, wow, he's really, really, really good when he has the ball in his hands. But look at all of the, and again, small sample size, but all of the data for when he's not the primary focus. Oh, man, then he's spectacular. And so when you think about that in the NBA level, it's, all right, so when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, he's this great spot-up shooter who's a really intuitive cutter, and also he's this great help defender. It's the opposite of the, I don't know what he does when he's not the focus. It's, if only there could be more time when he's not the focus, because look how good he is at everything else.
I think it's the part of the game where if you could stand out in a positive way, it takes your ceiling, in my opinion, to another level. And it was something I was not expecting, like watching his tape, then looking at the numbers, I was like, wait, what? Like these are right? Like these are correct? And you start watching the tape and you're like, okay, this is very dangerous now. If you can be this effective off the ball, and it's not like you have to be elite at it. It's just you have to be good enough to where like teams can't just be like, well, just get the ball out of his hands. Because it's one thing to be great with the ball in your hands, but it's like, well, the NBA is going to take away whatever you do best. So if you're great with the ball in your hands, they're going to be like, well, let's just get it out of his hands. Like, well, let's just work to get it away. But if you can also make an impact off the ball, that's where things get really dangerous. And I had some people reach out to me earlier in the year and were like, hey, can he be a point guard? And I'm like, well, yeah. And then I was like, but it makes it even more dangerous because I think he's going to be able to play off the ball. So now you have, if you have a good point guard, like I'm just throwing out, like with if he goes to the Wizards and they have Bub Carrington and Dylan, you can play off of each other. Like, and you have a positional advantage with the size. You know, it's just a unique weapon that, like, no matter who's in the lineup, like if they slide Tyshawn George to the two for some reason, and you have Dylan. It's like, well, my gosh, you're humongous in the backcourt, and you can run sets each way. It just kind of gives you – coaches will drool for that. Like, you, oh, man, we can do a lot of stuff with Dylan now and these sets. He's so smart on the court, not just with the ball in his hands, but he's timely cutter, good coming around screens, like the off-ball stuff. It's a lot of really good stuff that you – it just quickly like takes when I'm evaluating, and you can also do that stuff as a potential guard, like throw you like another tier. I'm just throwing you up the board. I'm like, woo, this takes you very high up there, because makes you that much more of a complete player and a headache for defenses to try to figure out how to slow you down. And if you're hitting shots off the ball and then you're all of a sudden dicing people apart with the pick and roll game, it's like, how do we stop this guy? He's doing everything. So that's the defensive flashes I was a little bit more like excited about. I was bummed about the consistency, but that, and then also the off-ball stuff. When I watched Harper the last time, I was like, those really stood out to me. And the off-ball is just like, oh man, if you're also going to be this type of player, we know what you can do with the ball in your hands. But now if you're really going to have this too, like that's a complete guard right there.
And that's where the size comes into play. Mm-hmm. Of if you're a 6'2 guard, you essentially have to be either so ridiculous offensively that it doesn't matter. Like, either you have to be Ja Morant, Jalen Brunson level of offense to where it doesn't matter. Or if you're 6'2, you're the point of attack guy. Like, you have to be that. With Harper, because he's 6'6, there's that flexibility, right? Of, okay, you know, if he, you know, ended, right? Like, he could be the Luka Doncic to a Jalen Brunson type, right? When they were both in Dallas before Dallas became what Dallas is today, you know, that concept, right? With Harper, you can play him with a smaller guard if that's what makes sense for your team, or you can play him in a jumbo set, as you mentioned, if that's what makes sense for your team. There's not, again, you know, Maxwell has talked quite a bit about smaller guards, so I don't want to tread all the way into his corner. But I think conceptually, part of the idea is if you are that smaller guard, there are just more boxes that you have to check to get mm-hmm. on the court, right? With Harper, it's, and I think part of the reason why I'm so high on him is he's got this kind of crazy combination of both, where if he were 6'2", I believe in his ancillary skills enough that I think he would be a really good 6'2 guard. But because he's not, there are fewer holes that you have to fill. There are fewer things that you need to be concerned about because, you know, okay, he's struggling to adjust to NBA speed. That's fine. We'll throw him on the slower guard, no matter how big they are, because we're confident that he has the size, because he does have the size, right? It's just, you know, I talk all the time about avenues to playing time, right? Of, okay, are you going to earn your minutes on the defensive end or the offensive end? Are you someone who you are, you know, say a backup big man type where your only minutes are going to come at the five, or are you someone who's positionally versatile, right? Harper checks all of those boxes, where if you want to have him be your pure point guard and have him just run the attack and that be it, he can do that really well. But the off-ball stuff as well, right? As you mentioned, I think it's the most important thing to mention. At the NBA level, they will take away what you're best at. And for some people, that, you know, again, not to be unkind to Jalen Hojofino, but just going back to that, because that's one that I knew that I know now that I was quite wrong about, the idea being, what else is there? That, I think, is becoming more and more important. Of the sort of one-trick pony types have been drummed out of the league in pretty rapid fashion. And with Harper, again, it's just, okay, you take away my sixth gear, great, I've still got 1 through 5. Okay, you take away my on-ball brilliance, that was a phrase that made sense. Great, I'll just stand off ball, I'll be a great spot-up shooter, I'll be an incredibly intuitive cutter, I'll make defenses pay that way. He just has so many different avenues to affecting the game that you can find a way to fit him into essentially any lineup, which, you know, again, Ja Morant is a superstar. Jalen Brunson is a superstar, right? Like, the difference here, though, is you know, and again, it goes back to the Cade Cunningham comparison as well. If you have a more limited toolkit, but you use all of those tools perfectly, you're a Hall of Famer. But if you have the full toolkit and you can use it at that high of a level, that's when you go beyond the, you know, Hall of Famer, perennial all-star type and talk about, oh, this could be one of the guys that we talk about, one of the, you know, top 75 type guys, one of the sort of stereotypical, I'll tell my grandkids about them kind of player, right? If you have the full toolkit and you can use it fully, that's a different ballgame than even the, and Luka is one of those people that we will talk about, right? But he doesn't have the top end speed. If you have the full toolkit and you can use it to maximal capacity, that's when you're in the upper echelon. And I truly think that, you know, part of the reason why I'm not moving off Haben Harper in that tier with Cooper Flag is I think both of them could be in that, you know, champagne room of the Hall of Fame kind of discussion. And that's a ridiculous burden to put on any prospect, which is why I want to be cautious about it. But with Harper, it's not only that he has that potential to be one of the top of the top players, but that it's easier to see, right? In the sense that it's easier to find comparisons for Harper than it is for Cooper Flagg, because we've seen this movie before with Harper. But I think to your point that you've made throughout the podcast, he's special enough that he might be different in the sense that in the, you know, 10 years from now, maybe rather than talking about the Cade Cunninghams and the Lucas of the world, we're talking about the Dylan Harpers.
Absolutely. I just, it's always so tough to put these lofty expectations. I think we always get excited, but like, I think there's two potential superstars at the top of this draft. I really do. I think at worst, I think they're like franchise altering pieces, which is getting you into that superstar category. So it's funny how you said that. It's going to be one of those classes where we'll probably 3 years from now be like, well, we're comparing him to Dylan Harper. It's like, oh, here we go again. We started over. Yeah. So I just think there's a lot to love with his game. I think there's a lot of nastiness. I'm terrified to see what he's going to look like with surrounded by NBA talent, like that offense, like, I think it might be a very loud shock to us of like, oh man, Dylan Harper's got now three capable shooters and some firepower around him. What's this going to look like? So I think it's just a special one. And, you know, plenty of people are going to talk about Cooper Flagg, but I think they should be talking just as much about Dylan Harper, because when he's been healthy this year, he's been unbelievable. When he's not, you know, deathly ill and losing 15, 20 pounds, he's been fantastic on the court. So Gonna be fun to kind of see how it pans out. But I just know a lot of teams feel the same way. They're very high on him.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap this one up?
No. It's always a pleasure, Nick. Thanks for having me. It feels good to talk about this one because I'm always like, oh, yeah, that was a good one. I forgot about how much I enjoy Harper. And like I said before, every time I turn on his tape, I find another thing I like about his game. Those are usually the ones where you're like, all right, that's telling me something. If I can't find a bunch of negative stuff, that's telling me something.
All right. Well, he is Tyler Rucker. You can find him all over the social media verse at Tyler_Rucker, running the No Ceilings account at Backcourt Violation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's all over the place. And you can, of course, find his written work over at NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the show, feel free to reach out to me either via Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Thank you.